Hi, I'm Charles Wolfworth. This is Hometown Alaska. You know, the Alaska Railroad is the reason why Anchorage is here. That's right. President Woodrow Wilson, 100 years ago, decided that there would be a railroad built through Alaska and it would start at Seward. It would run through Anchorage Bowl and go to Fairbanks. And then the folks who had to build it came to Anchorage to set up their camp and build it. Well, 100 years later, the railroad is still running. Now it belongs to the state of Alaska rather than the federal government. But it's still a pretty small railroad by railroad standards. And it is our own, as I remember Ted Stevens saying, our own Toonerville trolley. And it's also a super important part of our economy, moving goods through Alaska. That's our topic today, the Alaska Railroad, the challenges it's facing with loss of cargo, with some natural resource changes and changes in the refinery up in North Pole. And then also the passenger services and what you can get out of your railroad. And I've got two guests to talk about this who are kind of the two main people that I would have in the studio. Bill O'Leary is the CEO of the Alaska Railroad. Thanks for being with us, Bill.
Thank you, Charles. Happy to be here.
And Dale Wade is the VP of Marketing at the Railroad. Thanks for being with us, Dale.
Correct. Hey, good to be here as well.
And we hope to hear from you as well. The phone number here in the studio is 550-8433. If you're calling from outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And anything you want to know about the railroad, this is a great time to ask it. So Bill, I think the thing that's been in the news and the headlines for not only this year, but for the last couple of years, is that the business has become more challenging for the railroad. Coal prices have gone down. That's reduced the amount of coal being shipped out of Alaska. And now the Flint Hills refinery up in North Pole is closing. And I guess that was a pretty big part of your business in moving those tanker cars. How has that affected your bottom line, and what kinds of changes have you had to make to deal with those challenges?
Sure. It's been a pretty significant impact, Charles. There's no doubt about it. You know, just by way, just real big picture explanation. I mean, we have freight activities, passenger activities, and of course, we own a significant amount of real estate also. But freight is far and away our largest revenue source. And the petroleum haul from the North Pole refinery outside of Fairbanks in the North Pole area down to Anchorage has historically been our largest customer. Whoever's owned the refinery has been our largest customer. And when Flint Hills purchased the refinery in the mid-2000s, they actually were looking at plans to grow the refinery. But circumstances have conspired against them and against the railroad to some degree. So that haul, that freight line has, you know, fallen markedly over the years. I mean, we're moving somewhere in the neighborhood of about 1/7 of the product that we moved at its peak in the 2003-2004 timeframe.
So you've already lost your biggest customer, essentially.
Well, yeah, they're oddly enough, they are still our biggest customer.
Really?
Even
wow.
After that that fall. It was, you know, they were far and away our largest customer for an extended period of time. And as a result of that, the railroad has had to adjust. I mean, we're, you know, charged with being self-sustaining in that being able to, you know, to the extent possible, pay our own way going forward. And as a result of that, we've had to make, I would say, pretty significant reductions. It's been sort of a step-down process over the past 5 years or so, but since 2008, we've actually reduced roughly 300 positions on the railroad. Now, in the 2008 time frame, we were, you know, at right around 1,000 or a little less than that. But at peak now, we'll be year-round about 600 or less than that positions, and swelling up to about 700 during the busier summer season.
Wow, that's a huge change. So how do you make that kind of adjustment? Do you have to cut off some services that you're doing, or is it, I mean, there are fewer trains, I guess, if there's less tank cars moving?
Yeah. Well, it's been very difficult. Back in the, again, sort of the heyday of the Anchorage to Fairbanks freight service, we were running two trains each way each day. As the service, as the especially petroleum haul has fallen off, we've cut that back. We're down to now actually 5 day per week service. And that's just been a function of those petroleum volumes. We, you know, need to maintain that service, that level of service, certainly for the other customers we have on that train.
Or they might move to some other service.
Absolutely. Yeah. Everybody has options.
Mm-hmm. So Is there any prospect of another customer who could make up for that kind of enormous decline? I mean, is there anything on the horizon for the railroad in terms of cargo that could sort of turn that problem around?
Well, we certainly hope so. How's that sound? All right. Yeah, I mean, there is. I mean, you know, the railroad is a it's a key piece of infrastructure for the state. It's necessary that the railroad, continue on. And, one of the ways we have made significant cost reductions out there, you reach a point on this where, further reductions are, further really significant reductions are going to be much, much more difficult than the already difficult ones we've taken. So our focus going forward is certainly on growing the business. I mean, one of the catchphrases kind of using around the place, and has the added advantage of barely being the truth, is we are going to look to grow our way out of the situation we find ourselves in. So, Dale and his staff are out working hard both on the freight and the passenger side. We're certainly trying to be more aggressive in the marketplace and see what we can come up with. We think there's options out there. I think some of the growth that we've seen as a result of some of the increased activity on the North Slope has been promising for us. We think that there's perhaps opportunities for the railroad to be an integral part of an interim solution for some of the energy issues in the interior, if that were to come to pass. So, none of these things are going to just magically appear. But people need to know that the railroad is, it's alive and well and is going to continue to serve the state.
You're working on it. So, Dale, tell me about, I think that the public's impression is that a railroad is a way for people to move around. But traditionally, that's not been how you make money as a railroad, right?
No, traditionally, that's not, you're right. It's not about moving people. All of the what we call Class 1 railroads, the large railroads in the lower 48, like UP, Union Pacific, and BNSF and others, those are all massive billion-dollar Class 1 railroads, and they make most of them, all of their money on freight. Mm-hmm. So freight pays the bills. Now, here in Alaska, we're very different than that. Passenger service plays a significant role, albeit freight still is the king of the market in terms of revenue for the company. But we have a blended calling from the state to provide not only economic development, which involves movement of freight and goods throughout the state and supporting the companies within Alaska and the industries, but on the passenger side, we have a calling to carry passengers throughout the state, certainly in support of those that are coming to Alaska as visitors, but also as transit and the ability to move our own individuals throughout the system into remote markets where people choose to live, and we want to support those people.
Well, I rode my bike down the Ship Creek Trail last night, and I saw the big train with the princess cars, and it's kind of a sign of spring, is that the cruise ship cars are attached to the train, and there's big trains taking off every day. So does that that must be a significant thing for you to get to ramp up for the summer operations, and the cruise trip passengers are paying a pretty good fare to ride up to Denali and have essentially an excursion.
Correct. We play. I travel throughout the U.S. Pretty extensively, involved with tourism and as well as freight marketing. And what I'm always pleasantly surprised to find is that people want to do two things. First of all, Alaska is always a bucket list item. Mm-hmm. Anybody you talk to, you're pretty safe saying, well, come on up. And they'll say, oh, I'd love to come to Alaska.
Right. You say, I'm from Alaska. They say, I've always wanted to go to Alaska.
Exactly. Right. You'll get a positive response. Mm-hmm. So they've always wanted to come to Alaska. They want to go to Denali. Everybody wants to go see the big one. And then, of course, I'm very surprised at the number of people that say, I'd like to take the Alaska Railroad. The Alaska Railroad has a very strong reputation, even throughout the lower 48, and most specifically as a means of getting off the road system. So in terms of a way to see the state, we parallel the road for a while, and then we take a left and go off into the woods, and that's a nice way to see Alaska.
And it's a luxury product, really. I mean, it's
absolutely.
Very, very. I don't know. I wonder how many of our listeners have been on the train recently, because I have the sense that most of your passengers, especially going up to Denali, are visitors from outside. And if locals have been on, it's probably because they're going with friends and family.
Sure, absolutely.
And so they may not know what those cars are like. Just tell us a little bit about what that service is like.
It's a great car. We have two levels of service, what we call Adventure Class and Gold Star. And they are simply uniquely different. Neither is better or worse. Adventure Class are large, spacious seats. But it's the common way to see it in Alaska, and certainly we have far more cars that are committed to Adventure Class service. And then we have an upgraded service called Gold Star. And the Gold Star service is a premium upgraded double-level luxury dome car. Bars, eating upstairs, food and beverage service, table seating downstairs. Now, the table seating is available to Adventure Class. So if someone wanted to take a more economical approach, they could board the same train as the Gold Star, get on board in their own car, and when they're ready for dinner, go either to the cafe bistro or into the Gold Star seating. So you can eat either way, but certainly the upgraded luxury dome car, that's the way to see the best parts of Alaska.
Well, it always struck me, I used to write these travel guidebooks, and it always struck me in touring those cars that it's kind of more like an Orient Express or something. I mean, because you've got the unique Alaskan art, you've got the sort of the design of it, it doesn't feel like a train. You know, the Amtrak, totally different picture. You know, this is a unique sort of handcrafted experience.
Yes, they've got beautiful seating. The windows wrap all the way up around the top of the car to allow you to see the eagles up above. It's really the way to go.
Right, but the pricing is also, it's priced as an experience, because if I were to rent a car and go to Denali for like a week for what it would cost me to take the train.
Yes, you could. Yeah. You'd have to wait behind traffic and look at the bumper of the guy in front of you, but you could certainly do it.
Yeah. So is that business growing for you? Is it static, or how does that look?
Gold Star service is our fastest growing service. So even though there's a premium cost associated with it, it is the fastest growing service that we have. In fact, we're concerned about space capability in the future as the years go on. However, Seward, for example, now you can say it's because of great weather, we're into another year of outstanding spring, but the Anchorage Seward on the Coastal Classic train grew 15% last year. It was up tremendously, and much of that has to do with it's a reasonable distance. You can leave in the morning, get there, go out on a Kenai Fjords tour, come back same day, and by 10 p.m. you're back home in bed. So that's
you'll sleep well if you do all that.
Yeah. If you do it all, you should take a few days and explore further. Yeah. But nevertheless, those are day trips you can certainly.
Right. And I always tell people that's the trip that I would take. I mean, it's so spectacular. It's just mind-boggling. It's so gorgeous. So, yeah, I'm obviously a proponent. I'm not being unbiased here.
Yeah, the tourists always want to see Denali. And, of course, we know the best place to view Denali is really from Talkeetna. Mm-hmm. But they're missing something if they don't go on the south end through the sweeping S-curves up through Spencer to Grandview. Oh, you could just go back and forth and do that all day long. It is very
amazing.
Spectacular.
We're talking about the Alaska Railroad today on Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth, and I have two guests from the railroad, Dale Wade, who's just speaking as a vice president of marketing, and CEO Bill O'Leary is with us as well. And we'd love to hear your questions about the railroad. The number is 550-8433. That's the inside Anchorage number, 550-8433. If you're listening outside the area, it's 888-353-5752. That's toll-free. And emails will come right to my computer here in the studio at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Bill, we were talking about these challenges you're facing. Is there does increased passenger traffic offer a way out of financial difficulties for the railroad, or is it? I mean, that I know there's a lot of personnel costs. There's a lot of costs that go with providing passenger service. So I don't know if there's a lot of profit margin there. How does that figure into your total picture?
Well, passenger is very, very important, Charles. It's something that, first of all, as Dale sort of mentioned, it really does define the Alaska Railroad. I mean, freight pays a lot of the bills, but people think about the Alaska Railroad. Passenger is certainly the what comes most often to mind. We have experienced very nice growth curves on the passenger side. Took a little dip with the global recession in the 2008-2009 timeframe. Some of the tax issues affected some of the number of cruise passengers that came to the state, but we appear to be on a good solid growth curve going forward on that. And it is a contributor. It's a very solid contributor to the railroad. And the railroad is certainly better off with passenger service than without passenger service, just even from a financial perspective, but certainly from a marketing Alaska perspective.
Mm-hmm. But you have to have freight. You can't operate just as a passenger rail, I would think.
No, freight is the certainly the biggest dog in the fight here. Mm-hmm. It is. I mean, passenger railroads, depending if they're more on the commuter side than anything else, are almost inevitably subsidized. But our passenger service is, it looks a little bit different than what some others see out there, but it is a very solid contributor for us.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to Harry, who's calling about minerals, hauling minerals. Harry?
Hi there. So, Charles, you know me.
Oh, I hear your voice. former Representative Harry Crawford. What's your question, Harry?
Well, the governor talks all the time about roads to resources to open up the Ambler Mining District and all. And it just seems to me that the railroad is what's perfectly suited for hauling minerals and ore, if we build a road, it's hard to maintain, and the it seems to me that the railroad is much cheaper to build, much cheaper to maintain, and a much better fit if we were to open up the Ambler Mining District and open up the bornite and the Arctic deposit and some of those other really huge deposits up there that would make a lot of sense to both Northwest Alaska and to the Alaska Railroad as well.
Interesting question. And this is something that Governor Hickel always talked about, was building a railroad all the way to Nome and then maybe across Siberia. Bill O'Leary, is this something that's on your radar screen? Is that something you think would be possible?
Yeah, Charles and Harry, I think it is. It's something that we're very interested in, and as we work with at the state and federal level policymakers, we try to make sure that first of all everybody always remembers that the railroad is out there, and we like the term, or we prefer the term, corridors to resources rather than roads to resources, in that we think in some situations it could make better sense to put a railroad in first, and then if there needs to be a road to go along with it, that could make sense, and that could be a secondary. But from the perspective of being able to move large quantities of bulk or heavy or hazardous type materials, the railroads are vastly more efficient than trucks, or at least certainly from mm-hmm. from our perspective,
right,
on things. And as a result of that, we think that it's something that should be taken into account when statewide planning goes forth.
What does it cost comparison between putting in a road and putting in a railroad? I would assume that a railroad would cost more.
I couldn't tell you exactly what it mm-hmm. costs to put a road in, but I know what it costs to put rail in, and it's not insignificant. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it. It's highly capital intensive industry we work in here, but once it's in, you've got an asset that with proper care and feeding will last you for a long, long time. So you don't want to be laying track down for something that's necessarily going to be a short-lived type of thing. But for what you're talking about with some of these mining plays and things like that out there, that a railroad, we think, could make good sense.
Interesting. Harry, to answer your question?
Well, it seems to me that if they were to build this one lane seasonal road up there, it's going to cost just about as much as it costs to lay track. But they're going to get to Fairbanks. They're going to put it on the railroad anyway to ship it down to Tidewater. So
I hope so, because I don't want to see all those trucks on the highway. All right. Well, that's a great that was a great comment. Thanks for calling. Here's an email that's kind of on a similar issue. There was track that is being built to Point McKenzie, and I guess the legislature appropriated money to build portions of it, but not the whole thing. So there's just some discontinuous pieces built out there in the woods. And was that, did they appropriate the rest of the money to build those, that track this year?
No, that the Port McKenzie extension is about a 32-mile extension coming off of our main line at the Houston area and then connecting down into Port McKenzie. And this is actually an initiative from the Matanuska Susitna Borough. And the state is funding it. The general fund is funding that to Matsu Borough. And Matsu Borough then is effectively contracting with the railroad for getting the rail line in. It's, you know, give or take a $270 million project.
Wow.
Yeah, it's, did I mention things aren't cheap with rail? But, you know, that includes, I mean, land acquisition, that includes preparing the, you know, the ground for the rail, everything of that nature. I think they, I believe Matsu Borough received $13 million in this most recent capital budget. And that's going to leave them short somewhere, I believe, in the $85 to $90 million range to complete this this rail extension. So,
and it won't be usable until it's completed, obviously.
That's a true statement. Mm-hmm. You can only go so far without if you don't have it all the way.
Yeah, you can't jump it. Dale, did you have something to add to that?
Let me just speak to the fact that we're doing it in segments. Although there are multiple segments, the segments don't need to be done sequentially. So we could complete one segment and not another. So if we had a business opportunity somewhere along that line that justified advanced work in earlier segments, we could, the monies can be spent anywhere along the development plan. So essentially we could finish work from Houston X number of miles down track, access products that need to move to and from there. And eventually it needs to get to the port.
Right. So how many out of your 32 miles, how many miles are completed? You know?
Complete is one of those questions. I mean, there's no rail on it, but I mean, we've got a really significant construction program going on this year. There's because there's previous year's monies that have just been, you know, let to private sector contractors who are going to be out there working on it right now. But it's amazing the amount of embankment work and just dirt work that's been done over the past couple, 3 years. I was out there about this time last year, and it was just stunning what the place just bears no resemblance to what it was before.
Right.
And, you know, it's in a state that's really short on infrastructure, you know, optimistic that this project is going to be able to, well, it obviously adds to the infrastructure of the state that can be, you know, hopefully spur development going forward. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the emailer's question was sort of about the operation of this. And just summarizing the email, given the current challenges, how do you see the impact of the Point McKenzie rail extension on your network? Do you anticipate the need for an annual maintenance subsidy until such time as Point McKenzie grows into self-sustaining volume? And I guess the question then is, we do have kind of a build it and they will come issue in Alaska where some things have been built. I guess we could talk about the airport railroad station doesn't get a lot of use. So will there be volume there to pay for maintenance of the line once it's completed?
Well, let me say this. The opportunities will pay for the ongoing expense. Certainly, they're looking to the railroad to adopt this as our own and operate it going forth. And it is kind of a build it if you, they'll come if you build it for them. So no one will ship commodities to port until there's a railroad to ship those goods on. Mm-hmm. Now, somewhere along the way, and we've had numerous discussions, and we're still in discussions actively with companies that would be interested in ship every, you know, various types of commodity that might need to move by rail in massive quantity to that port or out of the port north. And given the right amount of volume, we'll be able to afford the ongoing expense maintenance.
From a business perspective, why would somebody use that instead of using the Port of Anchorage, which already has a rail line and a port? Is there a good argument from the business point of view? I know that taking coal all the way to Seward, you have to haul it over the mountains, and I've heard that whole story.
Sure.
And I guess there's no, but we're going to have a lot more land at the port after this expansion project is done, if it's ever done.
Yeah, it's got a lot of land. You know, kind of goes back to what Harry said. Mm-hmm. Should we develop the Ambler Mine areas and others northern end areas in mining, Well, you want to, Port of Anchorage is not a bulk container, a bulk port. It's more a container port. Now, they have some fuel lines that run across, and they bring in some various fuel commodities. But generally speaking, the design, as I understand it, from Port of McKenzie, is that we could bring in and out resources of Alaska.
So big piles of coal, big piles of ore.
Lime, ores of all kinds.
So that would
LNG could flow through there as well.
And that would cut the cost because you don't have to haul it all the way to Seward. Is that sort of the business argument for it?
Correct.
All right. Now we've got Rob calling to talk about trucking versus railroads. Rob?
Hi. Yeah, I was recently driving on the Parks Highway and encountered quite a bit of truck traffic, which got me thinking it's got to be more efficient to move freight by rail than by truck, yet clearly there's a lot of trucking. And so I guess I have a three-part question. What are the factors that determine whether a shipper is going to use a truck or the rail? Is there anything that railroad can do to increase the percentage of freight that's carried by rail? And assuming that relative speed is one of the factors that determines that, it's the last time I looked, the railroad was quite slow compared to the road. And I wonder, is there anything the railroad can or is looking at doing to increase the speed?
Oh, good question.
Yeah, those
who wants to take that
questions.
One or that series of questions? What are the factors that determine?
Let's start off with Dale for a couple of minutes. I'll chime in as we go.
I was going to say we'll split that one. What we call TOFSI, trailers on flat car, is our second fastest growing line of business. So we have done many things specifically this last year to improve the efficiency of that operation. It's still an 11-hour and 30-minute run from Anchorage north, but conceivably, trailers could be moved from tote ships, for example, or from a local purveyor placed on flat cars, and we can move 90 trailers in an evening. Well, that's 90 trucks or thereabouts off the road. Additionally, the studies have been done, and the fuel efficiency of a diesel locomotive is equivalent to 450 miles per gallon in an SUV.
Wow.
So movement of massive quantities of good by rail is very efficient, and it pencils out on the truck side as well. Truckers, again, their intent is to move goods from A to B, whether they pull them with a tractor or put them on the back of a train. Doesn't much matter. The reason we don't haul, the reason you see trucks on the road are two reasons. Number one is transit time. When you've got refrigerated goods or other time-sensitive commodities, they somewhat prefer to go by road over rail.
Because the truck can drive right to the door, the warehouse, correct. Whereas you have to unload.
Full truck loads. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other one is if it's a through truck. So if you load it in lower 48, move it to Alaska, and you're going to Prudhoe Bay, you may not want to handle those goods and transload onto a railroad. So it's either speed or handling. But we handle a lot of traffic every night, all 5 days a week.
Is there a way to speed it up, get it there quicker?
Well, I think that's been something we've been looking at. A couple different ways on that. There's the actual infrastructure itself, and then there's our operating practices. And, put a lot of effort in, especially of late, looking at the operating practices to see if there's ways to take any inefficiency out of that and basically provide better customer service and therefore more timely service. On the infrastructure side of the house, it's been an area of focus for the past really almost probably 13 to 15 years, maybe a little longer even, about increasing our track speed. And to do that, we've had a very aggressive schedule of track straightening. When the railroad was built initially, it was just built around whatever was in the way,
Built as fast as they could do it.
Built as fast as they could do it, and they weren't going to move a whole lot of dirt if we can just go around it here. And, that was great at that point, but it doesn't help for speed and efficiency in getting things between Fairbanks and Anchorage.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but is that the curves, is that the main thing that slows you down to 35 or whatever rather than the ballast and the strength of the track?
Primarily, it's curves. I mean, there were some, amazing curves out there, and we still have a couple of them. I mean, out around the Wasilla area, as an example, that's sort of the next project for us, funding dependent here, because it's a big project. It's, $40 to $50 million project that we're not in capacity to take on at this particular point. But, you can start cutting you know, things like 7-8 minutes off your time, which in one sense doesn't seem like that much, but you do that consistently with the number of trains, and all of a sudden it becomes a, you know, it's a real project that pays dividends to you. We have put, you know, well over $500 million into the rail over the past, as I said, 15 years or so. And a lot of that on straightening, you know, increasing our sidings, which are like our passing lanes, or, you know, double tracking in some situations. But it's all kind of part of the mix of infrastructure and operating practices to, you know, just provide that better customer service.
And Charles, our track is in very good shape.
All right.
We have very heavy rail capable of handling heavy equipment and heavy loads, and it is in good shape, especially compared to much of Lure 48.
All right. Well, it's a lively conversation about the Alaska Railroad today in Hometown Alaska. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with our railroad guests. Lots more questions, lots more things to touch on, and we will welcome your calls. I'll give out those phone numbers as soon as we come back from this short break.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Woolforth. Today, our topic is the Alaska Railroad, and our guests are Bill O'Leary, who's the CEO of the railroad, and Dale Wade, who's the Vice President of Marketing. And we welcome your calls, questions, comments. In Anchorage, the phone number is 550-8433, 550-8433 to get on the air with us. Statewide, there's a toll-free number, 888-353-5752. And email works well, too, hometown@alaskapublic.org. I get those messages, read them on the air, and that's a good way to get your questions answered as well. We've been talking about the railroad. I want to talk more in the second half about how you can get on the railroad. There's this fun and interesting new products that they have, taking folks just out into the wilderness and dropping them off for activities. And it's a very unique railroad in that way. But we've sort of been concentrating on the business issues because it belongs to us, belongs to the state of Alaska. We're the shareholders, and so we've been focusing a little bit on what makes the railroad go from a financial point of view. And one question I neglected to ask in the first half, as we're talking about this loss of cargo because of the closure of the Flint Hills refinery and reduction in the world market for coal, is there a threat that the railroad could simply not be able to pay its bills? What would happen if that were the case? I mean, can you turn to the state for support? Has that ever been an issue? What's your bottom line look like? And sort of what's the, I don't want to say the worst case scenario, but what happens if you can't get more business? Bill?
Sure. No, it's a valid question. I mean, it's something that, We've thought about, obviously, as the changes to the business environment out there have occurred, it's just it'd be imprudent for us not to be looking at scenario planning. Okay, what if this happened? What if that happened? To leave you just reiterating one last time, you know, the railroad is taking some hits, but it is still very much a going concern. It's still very much a viable entity going forward here and going to be there for our customers and for the state of Alaska. You know, if things were to, and I hate to use this term, but come off the rails, I mean, further for us, I mean, significantly further. You know, the railroad structurally is set up as an independent corporation. I mean, our liabilities are our own. They're not liabilities of the state. All that said, I think that the railroad is such a key piece of infrastructure, and while that sounds self-serving, it also has the added advantage of being the truth, that it's for this state that it would benefit nobody. There's nobody that would gain from the railroad, going out of business or not being able to operate. So my sense is that if it were to come to something like that, policymakers would, certainly not just turn a blind eye to the railroad.
So are you still in the black in terms of, and is that, including depreciation or just sort of on an operational level?
No, I mean, our books are set up to, even though we are owned by the state, I mean, we look, feel, and taste from a financial perspective much more like private enterprise. And that's the way our books are kept. That's the way it it looks. And, for 2013, or for 2013, we had, net income. So that's, net income on a generally accepted accounting principle basis of a little over $14 million. Now, that seems like a pretty healthy amount, but we have, as I mentioned, really significant capital needs out there. And we take all of our monies that we earn from our, freight business, our freight, passenger, and real estate activities, that, the leftover from that, and we, plow that back into the infrastructure to, keep the rail line in the healthy condition that Dale described. We also do receive some federal monies by virtue of our passenger service for that also. That also goes back into the line. So, with the changes in Flint Hills for 2014, and especially at what I'm calling full build out in 2015 timeframe, we don't anticipate our earnings to be at that level, but we're also not anticipating that we're going to be running in the red at all.
Does your real estate operation provide a significant amount of income, and is that a buffer against business reverses? I kind of recall that you have to get legislative approval to sell real estate, so I don't really know how that operates exactly. But I know you own a lot of property, right?
We don't own a lot of property. One of the, from my perspective, best aspects of the what we call the Transfer Act, where the company or where the corporation was sold from the federal government to the state, was that it came over with 36,000 acres of land with it. Now, we use about half of that, give or take 18,000 acres, in actual operations. But then the other half, the other 18,000, is available for use by governmental entities, the private sector, others out there. So we lease and we permit significant land holdings. We still have lots of other land out there that isn't leased or permitted. But you're absolutely right from the perspective that that real estate income we receive has acted as very much as a buffer against sort of the vagaries of the business cycle. Passenger and freight can still can dip or hem and haw, and real estate is very consistent for us. Mm-hmm. So it's a good thing for us.
We have a call from Dutch asking about connections. Dutch?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I was just curious why the Alaska Railroad has not connected up with the Canadian Railroad.
All right. And historically, I guess the railroad was just built with an authorization to go from Anchorage to Fairbanks. The Canadian Railroad ends up where? In Prince Rupert? Or where? I don't even know where it ends up.
Well, Prince Rupert would be one of the western origin
destinations. It's a long way from here, I guess, is probably the short answer.
The answer is cost a lot of money. But if the resources and the minerals were developed along the lines between Canada and the U.S., or Canada and Alaska, and additionally, if for some reason they wanted to move, this grand plan of moving, oil from Canada into the Alaska, then into the TAPS pipeline, sure, you'd need to, but you have to have enough commodity to maintain the line and to justify the capital expense, and the capital expense is quite high.
So it would take some kind of phenomenally rich resource to cover that kind of infrastructure investment.
Yeah, it's said, highly capital intensive to build and maintain. We have our Northern Rail Extension initiative ongoing right now, and that is, roughly an 80-mile project to take us from outside of Fairbanks, somewhere actually around the Eielson Air Force Base area, down to Delta Junction. And that's a four-phase project, you know, very expensive. We're just actually completing the first phase of that right now. That was funded partially from the state, or a little more from the Department of Defense. But it's a massive, for Alaska, bridge, about a 3,300-foot bridge over the Tanana River, right outside of Salcha, outside of Fairbanks area there. And what that's the reason that was done as the first phase of the Northern Rail Extension was it provides year-round access for the military to their training grounds. And with all of the issues facing Eielson and some of the other bases up there with BRAC realignments and closings, the continued ability for the military installations to be able to access that that training area is a big deal. That's a technical financial term.
All right. Thanks, Dutch. Let's go to Mark, who had a question about Flagstop trains. Mark?
Hi. Rather than a question, I'm just going to give an invitation to the CEO to come to a Flagstop party off the Flagstop train. This is Mark Butler, an old friend of his. Saturday, September 6th at Sherman, we're going to celebrate the Lovell family's 50th year as Flagstoppers. And we'd love to have the head of the company come and join us. And but more importantly, I just wanted to mention Flagstop service has grown greatly recently. It's very fun. You can get on the train 4 days a week in Talkeetna and go up 55 miles up and see many of us like myself who are homesteaders who get on and off the train. And I think it's a real fun deal and not too expensive price.
And it's a totally unique Alaskan thing. I don't know where else you can get on a train, hop off wherever you want, and then just wave a lantern or a flag and another train will come pick you up. Tell us about, how does that service work exactly? And it's basically year-round, right?
It originates in Talkeetna and runs on the weekends primarily. And it runs from Talkeetna up as far as Hurricane and back. But there are many communities along the way that are served by that. Talkeetna, Chase, Curry, Sherman, Gold Creek, Twin Bridge, Chulitin, and then stops in Hurricane and come on back. It is an Alaskan experience that every Alaskan ought to do because it gets you. First of all, Talkeetna is a great Alaskan town. It has truly an Alaskan feel to it. So you take the train up in the morning, then transfer over, jump on 1245, and just have a great day of it.
And you're going to meet some real Alaska folks on that train,
too. Real Alaska folks, absolutely. And that's the part we like about it.
Uh-huh. Is this the only Flagstop train left in the country?
It's the only one we know of.
So literally you just stand out on the tracks and wave
correct.
The train
down. And in the winter, the Aurora train, which is our the equivalent of the Denali Star, originates in Anchorage and runs north. And again, that acts as a Flagstop train in the winter as well.
And I've done that, and that is... it's just so spectacular. I mean, you will never get a better view of Denali. You will never see Alaska looking more gorgeous. And you're just in a one train car that just behind an engine and you just chug away across Alaska. It's amazing. Yeah. It's really well worth doing.
Well, it's one thing when I promote the company and our various trains because I'm paid to do that, but I sure appreciate Mark jumping on.
Well, I used to write these travel books, so I know an excessive amount about this stuff. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about the Alaska Railroad today with Dale Wade, the Vice President of Marketing, and Bill O'Leary, the CEO of the Alaska Railroad. Another caller I want to get to, but as long as we're talking about these special services, Dale, tell us a little bit about the Spencer Glacier trains. That's another one I think Alaska residents would be interested in trying out that probably a lot of people don't know about.
Correct. The Spencer Glacier train is phenomenal. You can copy that or take it if you want to stay on the train, go up to Grandview, which again is that spectacular view through the S-curves. But Spencer Glacier is a cooperative that we do with U.S. Forest Service. It was built at their request, and they've built quite a development out there where you can take the train either out of Anchorage. If you want to cut the cost and skip a little bit, you can drive to Portage, jump on the train in Portage, and run up the hill. And it goes from Anchorage, basically in the morning, up to Spencer. You can get off at Spencer. There's covered areas to get out of the weather if it's so inclement that day. Great landing area for the train. And then the train goes on, and you can spend the day in the woods. In fact, they've developed an extensive camping area, a big loop up there, so you can hike in about a mile loop up to Spencer Glacier and the Spencer Lake and actually spend the night or multiple nights. This year, the Forest Service is finishing the work on their first cabin. So there'll be a hard evening cabin you can spend the night in or soft tent it, whichever you prefer. But it's a great day trip. I did it for Father's Day, and it was just the right thing to do with the kids.
I'm just thinking it's a great family opportunity because you can what kid doesn't want to ride on a train, right? And then you're out in the woods and camping and away from the road.
Sure. And the U.S. Forest Service is out there, so they'll host and guide and tell you what to see and what not to see.
It ticks a whole bunch of boxes. It's just big fun out there. I mean, our family does it, and with a number of friends every year, and just you take the train out, you can camp out there. It's just a great, great area. So I recommend that. Only other thing I want to say to Mark, who called a little while ago, just send me the information on the Flagstaff info, and we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, sounds fun. All right, Caroline, I'm sorry to keep you waiting. You had a question?
That's not a problem, Charles, and you're correct, and children love trains. My father was a fireman on an old coal-fired train in North Florida many years ago, and one of my great memories is getting a chance to clamber all over the caboose when he took me down with him to visit some of his co-workers. The one thing before I get to my futuristic kind of question is one advantage to having the trains going out to the mineral developments is that the roads would give access to hunters, and I'm a big fan of hunting, but at the same time the indigenous folks have a problem with people having that kind of access from the roads. So lots of reasons why it should be trains that do that that transportation of minerals. But my question has to do with transporting people in the fastest way possible from Palmer and Wasilla and anywhere in that area. When are we going to get the tracks laid for the high-speed train? We are so far behind the rest of the world in high-speed trains that it amazes me that we're taking so long to get there.
Well, that's something that folks always talk about. And even if it's not high speed, is there a commuter opportunity there that would where the train could be competitive?
Yeah, walk before we run here with high speed. You know, commuter is a question we get asked a lot, and it's something that we were actually moving forward at least gingerly with. We put over the over last winter, we spent a considerable amount of time actually really doing a lot of internal work and reaching out to some of the different communities to put together a model as to how this would work, at least on a sort of a pilot program or demonstration type project to gauge interest in it, in running basically Wasilla or Palmer to Wasilla, I guess, to Anchorage. The issue, unfortunately, is one of finances. You know, even the best, you know, high-density commuter rail lines are subsidized by normally 50% to 60%. Startup commuters, it's often need to be subsidized up to 90%, you know, meaning the fare box will only pay for 10 cents for every dollar you need to spend on this thing. So with the changes on Flint Hills that occurred, we've had to delay or put on the shelf, at least for a while, our plans for commuter. I mean, we think it's the right thing to do in that it's a service to the people of Alaska, and we think it'd be good, but the Alaska Railroad can't handle it financially on its own, and we hope to continue to partner with the local governments, but at some level there's going to need to be them stepping up too, and with financial support for something like this, or some other entity stepping up with the
right. Well, in most places where you ride a commuter train, you start and then the train stops numerous times. People get on and off the whole way. Whereas here, everybody would get on at one spot and get off at another an hour later, which is kind of a different thing and probably less economical, I would think.
In our master plan, we plan on a number of stops along the way in populous areas, Chugach River, Fort Rich, if they want to come into town. Obviously, it would be better to take up commuter rail than to drive. Wear and tear of the car, fuel costs,
safety,
winter driving, who wouldn't want to? It's just a matter of affordability.
Right. So easier just to have a bus if you've only got 10 people to just throw them on a bus.
Yeah, there's a lot more than 10 that take the bus ride every day right now. So there's certainly tremendous interest.
So there's opportunity there.
Yeah, and Wasilla is still a very fast-growing community, outstripping Anchorage.
Interesting. Well, thanks, Carolina. It's Hometown Alaska. We've got about 10 minutes left. If there are other folks there with questions about the Alaska Railroad, the number here is 550 8433. Email hometown@alaskapublic.org. I do want to ask about the station at the airport. It was built, I guess, at the request. A request was made to Senator Stevens, and the money was appropriated. So the Alaska taxpayer didn't pay for it, though I pay federal taxes. And I don't see it being used. I don't think I've ever seen a train there, frankly. And I've been to public events. You know, it's a beautiful station, and so sometimes it's used for a reception or something. What's the status of that building? Is it used, and is it cost you money to have that building there?
Certainly it costs us money in upkeep and maintenance and whatnot, but it's heavily used during the summertime. Trains run directly out. Crystal Seas, for example, comes directly out of, or Silver Sea, runs directly from Port of Seward right up to the airport, park the train there. People come and go, and, of course, the inbound traffic, passengers that come off the airlines, board the train there and go directly to the ship. So it is used during tour season. The other 9 months of the year, it's very light use. And certainly we have receptions and meetings and different things out there. But it is used in the summertime as it was intended and built for.
All right. So, but it being used by cruise passengers, essentially. There's no, like, scheduled, like, I can't take a train to the airport.
Correct.
Okay.
Not at this particular point. It's, again, something we continue to look at. It's one of those things just from, again, it comes back to sort of the finances of the whole thing and how that would necessarily work. It comes back to our equipment need to be able to, you know, we've looked at the concept of running different shuttles and things of that nature from downtown to the airport. But it's, you know, it's one of those things that you can kind of look at and say, well, we're just well ahead of our time at some level on that, and that a lot of places have worked very diligently to be able to get rail service to the airport. We're there now. We just need to be able to put a model in place to put it to better use, because as Dale said, it is used, but just you know, be better if it was better used.
Right. Well, if you wanted to take the train to the airport, the center of Anchorage population is not at First Avenue where your depot is, right? So you need a number of other stations around town. There'd be a lot of infrastructure to do something like that, I imagine.
Correct. Certainly the places that make sense are Wasilla to the airport. If I were traveling, even if I worked in Prudhoe Bay and lived in the valley, it'd be nice to be able to take a commuter train that originated in the valley and went to the airport, and you wouldn't have to park, all that. Seward has expressed interest in having a commuter. But again, it makes sense seasonally because of the volume of the traffic of the passengers that come off the cruise ships every year, and they have a great need to move passengers. And just as with coal or anything else, we have the ability in rail cars to move, you know, 700 people per car, and that's quite a few bodies.
So I want to ask about the railroad's community profile. The railroad over the years has been a pretty good corporate citizen in terms of supporting local charities and having picnics and having kids go for rides. Have the economic difficulties you've gone through forced you to cut that back a bit?
Well, I think it's an interesting question, because it's one of those things that really does differentiate us from a pure, in some ways, private sector type corporation that would look entirely at the dollars and cents of something like that. We realize we have a, you know, greater responsibility to the state and its residents. So as a result of that, you know, even through our leaner times, we have done our best to try to keep that level of outreach. We think it's good for us. We think it's good for the communities. As an example, we held our open house a few weeks back in Anchorage here, and we're doing that every other year. One up in Fairbanks, and in alternating years, one in Anchorage, and trying to do one in one of the smaller communities too. And, you know, nothing short of absolutely overwhelming response. I mean, I think last I'd heard was something like 7,000 people came out. I mean, for, you know, train rides, look at the equipment, balloons, tattoos, things of, you know, other things of that nature. And
it's fun that you've got this relationship with the community, which I don't think other places do anymore. But the trains are cool. Everybody loves trains.
You know what? We love trains. And we think everybody should love trains. We want to be good neighbors. I mean, we really do. We realize we can be noisy. We can, you know, do things that sometimes make people unhappy, but you know, we want to try to work with the communities and the different groups to you know, to minimize that impact, to be the best corporate neighbor we can. Certainly, you know, helping out the charities and things of that nature, we try to do that. Still, not so much with cash type donations, but you know, we'll be able to, you know, donate seats on trains and things of that nature, and it seems to be working at this point. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We do Providence Hospital's a major fundraiser. We do in cooperation with Holland America Princess, and we're still participating. The reality, Charles, we are Alaskans. We're not Alaskan. We're not a company that passes through Alaska. We truly are Alaskans that happen to own a railroad, and so there's no reason why we wouldn't love the communities mm-hmm. that we go through.
Yeah. So in past years, there's been quite a bit of concern about some operational issues, and in the last couple of minutes, maybe we run through them. One was train strikes on Moose, trying to deal with that. And I haven't heard about that for a few years. I don't know, have you guys solved that one, or what's happening? Why do we no longer hear about that issue?
We've asked the Moose to stay off the tracks.
You sent out a mailer to them?
Yeah, we did. It was an email, actually. No, I mean, we've actually done quite a bit of outreach and effort on that about, you know, clearing and things like that to try to give. I mean, what happens on that is just on the heavy snow years, the Moose gravitate towards the open path. Well, the open path, unfortunately, is the train track. And so we've, you know, in high density areas or areas that are known to be problematic like that, we've made extra effort to, you know, try to cut paths to give them a way out and a different opportunity. And as a result, the number of strikes that we've had, now granted, it has not been, you know, heavy snow years the last two, but numbers are markedly down, which is good for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And the other big one over the years was the control of vegetation along the tracks and control about substances that were used. Again, it hasn't been such a big issue. Did you find a way of dealing with that resolved those concerns?
That's been a very tough issue for us over the years in that, you know, it really has come down to a safety issue for us. And, you know, our regulatory agencies come up here or had come up here and said, you know, the ability or the ways you're doing it right now have not been effective and you need to find a better way to do it. So, you know, we've taken a very, it's kind of an overused term, but it's the truth. I mean, a very open and a very transparent approach to this, conducting very significant public outreach, much more so than is required by, you know, the governing regulations on this, to let people know what we're doing along the way of, you know, vegetation control. And it seems to be resonating at this point. I think people understand the issue and have been you know, much more understanding, if not understanding, more understanding about the approach we've had to take.
All right. And Bill, Dale, I think you wanted to mention some of your reduced prices and some of your stuff. Give your pitch to get folks on the railroad.
As we talk about, Charles, as we talk about things to do this summer, we want everyone in Alaska to understand that there's a standing 20% discount for Alaska residents and active military. And additionally, there's a 50% discount for children. So whereas all these things are wonderful to do when you have guests from a lower 48 coming up, as I do this weekend, going to the Spencer Glacier or Grandview or down to Seward or up to Talkeetna or to the big one up in Denali or Fairbanks, those are all long trips. There's some nice short trips that can be quite affordable given the 20% discount and children fare.
Mm-hmm. So the way folks find out about that, I guess, is alaskarailroad.com or...
You got it. That's the best way.
Do you need to make reservations way ahead or use usually room?
In peak season, July, it's going to be pretty heavy. I'd recommend reservations, and certainly it's best to call first. The price doesn't change if you call, so do it.
All right. Well, thanks, both of you. That was Dale Wade, Vice President of Marketing for the Alaska Railroad. Bill O'Leary, the CEO of the Alaska Railroad, was with us as well. And next week on Hometown Alaska, Kathleen McCoy is going to be here to talk about high school graduation rates in Anchorage, big issue that's received a lot of discussion. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolfworth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.